Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina. With me in studio today is Doug Poirier, Director of IT at Stanodyne. Doug, welcome to the show.
Hi, Andrew. Great to be here.
Thanks for coming down and for joining us. And if you could maybe share with our listeners, what got you interested in technology way back in the day? What sparked the career in IT?
So this is long before anything like ordering different types of products online. You couldn't even look at anything except in something like a catalog. And I remember visiting with my grandparents. Basically, I guess we could call it as a Christmas show, and there were a lot of different electronics. And I happened to see a Commodore VIC 20 and kind of played with that. I was probably, I don't know, 10 or 12 years old, just fascinated with it and begged for it for Christmas. I didn't think I would get it, but did. And off we went from there.
Yeah, you're a member of the Commodore Army. There's a whole bunch of folks that have been on Underserved that got their start with a VIC-20 or a Commodore 64.
That's right. Yeah, we couldn't afford a Commodore 64. Eventually, I worked my way up to, I believe it's the most popular Commodore, was the Amiga 500. Great memories of the Amiga 500.
And then you must have been the person with the data set, patiently waiting for programs to save and load.
Oh my God, that was awful. Yeah, I had a cassette recorder connected to the VIC-20. And that's how you bought programs, if you didn't want to key them yourself, and you would pop the cassette in. And I remember you would issue a command that basically opened an input pipe, and then you would literally push play on the cassette player that was connected to your computer. And then, gosh, 15 or 20, at least 15 or 20 minutes later, the program was ready. So you would start that process, and then you'd leave to go do something else, because you weren't going to sit there, obviously, for 20 minutes. Completely normal. Nothing unusual about that. Very much just part of being a computer guy back in the day.
Can you imagine that if kids these days like press their app and then have to wait 20 minutes for
exactly.
it to load?
Yeah, there are web statistics, right, where if you don't grab somebody's interest in tenths of a second, you can lose them. And yeah, that was it. It was 20 minutes to play a crappy game, by the way. These are terrible games.
And did you take some CS classes as well?
Yeah. So in high school, we were pretty fortunate, actually, in high school to have a computer science program. Was it? Or was it? I think it was called computer science. In any event, they were TRS. So Radio Shack had a line of computers. And a lot of folks my age probably remember them. They were nicknamed lots of different things. None of them complimentary.
The Trash 80.
Yeah. Trash Can 80. Yeah. And it was a CRT in this. I mean, it's straight out of a 1970s movie. I swear to God. Keyboard built in with the monitor, if I remember correctly. And there were two, if you're lucky, 8-inch floppy drives alongside the monitor, the CRT. Yep.
Did you continue with the CS in college as well?
I did. I confess, it wasn't bragging at all. I was so interested in it, intrigued by it, that what was some really helpful, I'm sure, introductory classes to computer science, I found myself pretty quickly bored with. Found a job that you could tenuously say was associated with IT, because there weren't a ton of them, at least not available to me back in the day, and I left that and went right into the workforce.
And was that a Canadian Container Limited?
That's right, CCL. Yeah, a factory that made hairspray like Aquanet.
Ooh.
Made pallets of Aquanet and Niagara spray starch, amongst other things. And yeah, so I was involved in quality, but because the quality person had to work a computer, which was just crazy, I did learn a lot about working with a computer, making it do things in a business. That was a third shift job, so that was pretty rough. I was glad to move on.
Oh, that's so hard to stay up all night.
Yeah, it's terrible. Yeah, the weekends are the worst. But yeah, as I said, I did learn a lot. Laser printers were pretty novel, at least for that company that I was working for. It's just interesting because it was such an innocent time. A lot of things were new. And if you could do the most basic and rudimentary things with a computer, you were really looked up to. You were an integral part of the success of the organization, even being a lowly little 20-year-old, whatever I was.
In the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king.
Perfect. That's exactly right. Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
So did you continue in IT in your next job at Designs, Inc.?
Yeah, that was, I guess you could say, my, quote, first real IT job, unquote, where I was a bench technician. So yeah, crawling around under desks, pushing down, I believe that was Cat 3 cable, 10 megabit per second. Novell ran the enterprise there. And my first experience with a color laser printer, Yeah, that was interesting too. All these things now that we completely take for granted, you wouldn't really think too much about dropping a couple $100 on Amazon, was, I think it was $10,000 or something like that for this color laser printer. That's amazing how things have changed. Great story. The HR guy ran Human Resources for Designs Inc. came right from Disney. I don't know how we landed him, but that guy was phenomenal. If I remember right, his name was Matt. He would hire, it sounds creepy, but I swear it was really sweet and nice, mimes. Yeah, mimes, like with white face and the gloves and everything, and had carts with popcorn. So, you know, like a kettle, and people would be walking around the halls, mimes, and these guys pushing carts with popcorn, and they'd stop by your cube or wherever you were, and they'd say, well, today's an ice cream social. Would you like a sundae? And yeah, you're working on whatever it is that you're working on. I was new to Photoshop at the time. It was a fun place to work.
Ice cream, popcorn, and mimes.
Yes. Honest to God. It's all the truth. Yeah. Crazy.
Wow. That's a crazy formula. And from there, did you move on to the insurance industry?
Yeah, I went to MetLife. Boy, that was quite a juxtaposition between MetLife and Designs Incorporated.
No mimes?
No. Well, I guess it depends on your definition of a mime, but no mimes at MetLife, but just a corporate juggernaut. First of all, it's banking, it's in underwriting, very risk averse, being an insurance company, of course. And that type of attitude completely permeated the business. So it, not at all the same type of fun, carefree workplace it felt like Designs was, but interestingly, not immune to mishap. My supervisor at the time had been migrating, well, responsible for migrating folks from Lotus Notes, and had left her and her core team on one of the last Lotus Notes servers with a single SCSI disk attached to it, which failed. And she lost all of her mail. She was really quite put out by that. So she grabbed a few of us, myself, Art, and Hank, and we went down to the data center, which was enormous. Again, something like you might see out of a movie, raised floor, acres and acres of racks. And we were on our hands and knees because it was at the bottom of the rack. And we cracked open the server case and we fished out this 5-inch hard drive, and we just could not get the thing to spin up. So eventually I said, well, we can open it and see if we can get the spindle started because it just wouldn't spin up. And yeah, it didn't work. We opened it, which was quite interesting. But yeah, we got it spinning, but it wouldn't read any data. And that was it. She lost all of her mail.
He's dead, Jim.
Yeah. It was an interesting lesson, Andrew, because I guess it's such an antiquated expression, but never look at the cobbler's shoes. You know, here's one that espouses making sure all these backups happen and really having this responsibility for governance around data integrity at the organization. She lost all her mail. Yeah, it was really crazy.
That's a heck of a slice of humble pie.
Hey, listen, we all learn lessons in different ways, right?
So then you moved on to Brunswick New Technologies, right?
Yeah, so M&As happen all the time, right? So Brunswick New Technologies was originally North Star. And North Star made marine navigation equipment. And as a matter of fact, the salespeople had like a little in-joke, and they would say regarding the boats that the navigation equipment would go on to, it's not a boat if you can't land a helicopter on it. So that was the clientele to which North Star sold their equipment. And yeah, I moved on to network administration there. So I interviewed, I think I did well, I was pretty pleased with myself. And then I remember the Monday I started, I wanted to take a look around and see, all right, let me survey my domain. Let's see what's going on here. And the first thing that I saw was the primary and nearly only, I think there were only two or three servers in total at this company. It wasn't particularly big, about 150 people in total. And they had a compact ProLiant pedestal server. So this is about the size of a mini fridge, actually, on casters. So you could move it around if you actually had to. And that compact server was perched on top of a 3-drawer file cabinet. So I walk into our shared lab office area, and I was kind of taken aback when I saw it because it was new. And I said, what's that? And yeah, Joe Z was there. And he said, oh, that's our Exchange server. And I about had a heart attack. So the very first thing I did was I walked around the building and I announced to everybody that I was taking down this particular server called Polaris. That's the North Star, right? So that's why they called it Polaris. And everyone was very grumpy with me. Not a very popular thing to do your first day, but I could not live with this server sitting, honest to God, on casters on top of a 3-drawer file cabinet. Next thing I saw was the primary network, I guess you would call it the MDF, main distribution frame. They had just kind of organically grown over time, which is great. You know, company prospering, doing well, getting more people involved. And they had, if I remember correctly, a 24-port, 10-megabit hub, upon which they had added all the rest of the networking equipment over time, which included 100-megabit switches. But they were all bottlenecked. Every one of these downstream network devices were all constrained because at the top of the stack was a 10-meg hub. So that was a couple of weekends. And you would see in a picture of this rat's nest of cabling. Took a couple of weekends to get that all sorted. Yeah, that was good times, good times.
Now, that's the first place that you got to build out a data center on your own, right?
Yeah, it's interesting because the company continued to do really well. And as I mentioned, was Northstar Technologies and was purchased by Brunswick. Not a lot of people maybe know that Brunswick owns things like Hatteras Yachts and Mercury Marine. So big company, actually. And Brunswick, the CEO of Brunswick, a guy named Dusty McCoy, had a vision. He said, if I go buy a car, I don't have to immediately go to some sort of electronic dealer and have them put a radio in it. Why, when I go buy a boat, do I have to go buy electronics for it? So he bought Northstar and some other companies. And really, we were doing super well. And we added on, I think it was 30,000 square feet to the building. And I got to build up my very first data center. So dedicated cooling, dedicated racks, access control, power conditioning. It was a really great learning experience. A lot of pressure, honestly, for somebody like me back at that time. Definitely made a few mistakes, things I might have done a little bit differently. But in the end, everything worked out.
Now, years later, you ended up having to be the guy to help migrate that data center, right?
Yeah, that wasn't so much fun. And it was really kind of shocking when you think about how that was done back in the day. So eventually, it was determined that it didn't make a lot of sense to keep all these important pieces of data out in this remote location. The headquarters was in Forest Hills, Illinois. So in any event, they wanted to pull all the servers and the storage, et cetera, back to that primary data center just outside of Chicago, and flew a crew in, and we proceeded to take all the equipment out of the racks, put it onto pallets, and we loaded it into a rental van. A guy named Phil W., and crew got in this rental van with priceless data, in my opinion, in the back of this thing, and drove from Acton, Massachusetts, out to just outside of Chicago, where they proceeded to take it all back over one weekend. And it started Friday night. And Sunday, they racked it all up in the primary data center, turned it all on, and lo and behold, it worked.
Lucky no heads crashed with a bump in the road or something.
Any number of things could have gone tremendously wrong, but none did.
Get the van stolen in Rochester.
Could have been in an accident. They could have spilled a drink. Who knows what could have happened? But yeah, nothing went catastrophically wrong. They just re-racked it, hit the power buttons, and all came back up.
But some things did go catastrophically wrong when an email arrived with the message, I love you, right?
I love you. So yeah, it's funny now, but boy, it was not funny then. It was terrible. Yeah, this is back in the day when viruses were more like vandalism. It was almost sweet, actually, compared to how things are today. It's all about money, get it. But somebody wrote a virus, and it was back in the Windows 95, 98 days. And this is, if you may or may not remember, that when you named a file and you had an extension on the end of it, that was just it. So if it was filename.txt, the GUI, the interpreter for Windows, would just show it as a text file. But you didn't have to do that. You could put a second extension on it. So that's exactly how I Love You worked. I Love You was a text file, but a text file that it was actually a Visual Basic script. So it was iloveyou.txt.vbs. And when you clicked it, it ferreted out all your contacts and sent an email to them that said, Andrew, I love you.
Who wouldn't open it?
So you come in the morning and your boss has sent you an email and it said, Doug, please have a look at this. And then there's a file attached that says, I love you. So everybody opened it. And of course, everybody's contact lists got raided by this thing and absolutely choked our Exchange server. So It did have a pretty rough payload, actually. The first gentleman that opened it, I won't use his last name, but his name is Mark. He worked in our marketing area.
Mark from marketing.
Mark from marketing, no pun. And one of the things, if I remember right, that I Love You did was it erased JPEGs, maybe more than just JPEGs, but it erased picture files. If I recall correctly, it overwrote the file with just empty data. So the file name was still there, but the picture wasn't. Yeah, and we had had photo shoots of the products done and all kinds of things. And as we found out, as Mark painfully learned, if you keep stuff where we don't know about it in IT to back it up, if something goes terribly wrong, we can't get it back for you, particularly because the files weren't deleted, so we couldn't go get them back. They were overwritten with blank data. So the file was still there. The integrity was still there. It just happened to be empty. There wasn't anything. So that was a terrible lesson. And what ended up happening, as I said, was everybody ends up getting this email that says, I love you. And people, one after the other, kept opening it. So there was a PA at North Star Technologies, and I would pick up the phone periodically and just make this panicked announcement over the public address system that said, if you get an email that says, I love you, don't open it. Do not open it. People didn't listen to me. So yeah, we had about 3 days of cleanup, just opening up the Exchange outbound message queue, deleting, if I remember right, tens of thousands of messages, which is just phenomenal for that time. And eventually, we did kind of get back in business, so to speak, but that was terrible. Yeah, that was quite a learning experience to see how that worked. That was social engineering. We talk a lot about phishing campaigns, vishing, smishing, SMS phishing, which I think I got one last night. It's just the same thing. It's just playing on a human's emotions to try to get them to do something, and telling people that you love them when they don't expect to hear that is a surefire way to get somebody, apparently, to take action.
Oh, I wonder if there'll be an I Love You 2.0.
One would think there would be, right? Yeah, it was really very, very effective, I guess, in looking back at it.
Hey, sport. How was school today?
It was okay, Dad. How was work?
Ugh, actually, I had a rough day. Leading an engineering team is hard. I mean, I have to ship new software, meet deadlines, and tackle new projects while keeping my team focused on the day-to-day. It's hard to keep up.
Jeepers, Dad. Why don't you call Syrinx? They're the software engineering firm run by software developers. They helped Billy's dad. He used to be stressed out like you. He was missing deadlines, his team was overworked, and a bunch of folks left the company because it was too stressful. But then he called Syrinx. And they put developers to work right away. He hit all his deadlines and freed up his team to do other work. His boss was so happy Billy's dad got some extra time off.
Time off? Wow. What did he do with that?
He spent it with Billy.
That's a swell idea, son. I'll call Syrinx today. Now, you go wash up for supper.
From there, you moved on to Lensa?
Yeah, Lensa. Again, another M&A story, merger and acquisition. Lensa, like Porsche, L-E-N-Z-E, company owned out of Germany, Hameln, Germany, actually the town of the Pied Piper. And yeah, I moved on there, was a network administrator, I believe, when I joined, then had a network and systems management position, and then eventually had responsibility for the Americas for IT, right? Yeah, Lensa was an interesting place to work because we onboarded SAP. Not everybody maybe knows about SAP. SAP is a pretty big and powerful enterprise resource planning tool, and we had moved from, I guess one could say, a more forgiving ERP, smaller mid-market. You could make it do things that maybe were helpful in the moment, but long-term, you might have been better off to do things, quote, the right way. And that type of flexibility did not exist in SAP. You can't trick or fool or manipulate data in SAP. Very Teutonic, very German. And we came to really love working in SAP at Lensa. Had a customer service manager, Christine, at Lensa, and drove a lot of business process improvements, one of which was the beginnings of a SharePoint, which I'll be happy to talk about maybe here a little bit coming up. But SharePoint, wonderful information management platform for enterprises.
I remember we've been working with it since 2003. We've been doing client projects with it since 2004. But nowadays, it's just gotten so much more accessible with Office 365.
That's right. It's interesting because when you talk about the Office 365, I have nothing to do with Microsoft other than being a user. When you talk about Office 365, one theme, I guess, that runs through it that really does seem to bear fruit is that there's a lot of attendant benefit in living in the same ecosystem. The Office applications, the productivity suite, Word, Excel, PowerPoint, they all play nicely with Teams and with SharePoint and with OneDrive. And for those organizations that have the ability to kind of train up their employees, I think they see tremendous benefits, real dividends immediately when making those investments in the Office 365 ecosystem.
It used to be if you wanted to have that little walled garden that you're talking about there with all the things working together, you had to stand it up yourself and stand up AD and get everything authenticating correctly and deal with the care and feeding. And I was pretty dubious when we moved to Office 365. We used to be on some little SMTP provider for our email. And I finally gave up and said, okay, we'll move to 365. But then you do keep finding these little benefits like, oh, we've got SharePoint already and everyone's already authenticated with their email login. So let's use it for this.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Andrew. And it's interesting because, you know, when you start thinking about the beginnings of that kind of interoperability and you think maybe back to Link or Skype. Microsoft made a product, unified communications product called Link, L-Y-N-C, that eventually they just changed the name. They bought Skype and they just started calling it that. And you would have things like presence information. So you'd be interacting with somebody, collaborating with someone, you're waiting on maybe some numbers to come back from this analysis that's happening. You got to do a presentation or something. And what is Sally doing? Does Sally have this thing ready yet? And you can see Sally's available. So there's a little green mark next to Sally's name in Skype. And you could progress the fidelity of the conversation, I guess one could say, from a chat to a conversation, right? You just click the little dial button before you know it, boom, you're talking to that person. And then you're like, I'm just not understanding what you're trying to explain to me. And then Sally turns on screen sharing. And before you know it, you're looking at the spreadsheet. And all of this type of really rich collaboration was the stuff that was talked about and promised with things like maybe Cisco telepresence, right? You've got these video conferencing systems and big ticket items. And really what I think was a huge turning point was this lowly little unified communications client in Link and in Skype, because you get to just build up the richness of that interaction with your colleague. And then when you think about layering on top of that, a single system of record, right? We talk about SharePoint. SharePoint has OneDrive as its back end, and we struggle, all of us do. Sometimes I give a presentation and I'll ask from board members through individual contributors, I ask people for a show of hands, have you yourself, I'll ask you right now, Andrew, have you yourself ever created a document? And at some point in the future, you went to go look for that thing and you couldn't find it. You couldn't find it. Every hand goes up. I don't care who it is. It's happened to everybody. So when you think about the richness of this collaboration environment and you think about single system of record in SharePoint, it's accessible from anywhere. You always know where that policy is going to be or that form that you've got to fill out is going to be. Really a powerful advantage for organizations that can do it well.
And that's the latest version. You don't have to go through your emails and like, did Sally send me the latest one or is the latest one from Doug or whatever? You go to that SharePoint directory and the latest one is checked in.
Absolutely true. It can actually be a little bit harmful, dangerous. Maybe that's a little bit too strongly worded. But if you have colleagues that are operating from the wrong version of a document, right, they can be maybe potentially doing the wrong thing. And you're telling them, by the way, to do the wrong thing because they don't have the right version of the document that says, oh, don't do that thing anymore. Start doing this thing now instead. Yeah, so you're absolutely right, Andrew. Another really powerful advantage is the built-in version control. Can't overlook that.
Well, and if Frank then goes in and defiles the copy that everyone's using.
You have a chat with Frank.
Then Sally can come back in with the version control and roll it back and be like, nope, here's the right one.
Yeah, that's right. I'm really glad you raised that point because there's still this, depending on the industry, there is a rigorous chokehold. Boy, again, that might be too strongly worded, but there is this passion for what's perceived as the pristine integrity of a file. And you cannot allow someone to change that file because they may not have the authority or they may not make the right change, as you just said. or they can make a mistake. So you need to have this protracted, long safety net, got to go through multiple approvals before you can, quote, publish this document. And really, in practice, what that does is it slows down companies. Nobody's trying. Frank's not trying. Well, one would hope. Well, you never know. Frank might need a talking to. But one would hope that nobody's trying to do the wrong thing, right? So perhaps somebody is trying to do the right thing, but they make a mistake. And as you said, Sally, just goes back in and rolls it back down to the previous version. No harm, no foul. Off we go. No difficulty. And when you think about removing all of those headaches and roadblocks of that multi-stage approval chain, just taking that out of the equation, what you end up with really, genuinely, is a much more nimble, a much more flexible organization that does exactly what a lot of leaders promise to do. Empower, entrust, get the problem solving closest to the people that are encountering the problem, allow them to amend that document, make it better, enrich it. And then if somebody makes a little mistake, easy peasy, just roll it back. You have a little chat with Frank. Frank learned something maybe he didn't know before. And now off you go. You're a better quality organization.
Yeah, the same sort of thing that the developers quickly realize with something like Git, where you can collaborate and accept changes from people, reject them, roll back. I think when the rest of the enterprise realizes how powerful that is with all of their documents, it, like you said, quickly makes everyone feel a little more empowered to make changes, actually get stuff done, and things don't work or whatever, like we can roll it back. And, you know, someone is kind of the moderator of right. the docs and can, you know, kind of keep an eye on them and make sure that the best version stays out there.
You're spot on, Andrew, because I think that what you can take away from that particular scenario, the one you're talking to there, is there can be some criticality, right? You can have some things that are really important you have to kind of safeguard and protect. But by and large, get out of people's way. Do that type of rigorous control for those types of documents, that type of information in the organization that needs that kind of oversight and that type of shepherd to kind of guide it. But if it's something that really can benefit from the type of collaboration that you just talked to, get out of people's way.
Absolutely. Now, I think while you were at Lensa, you also got exposed to virtualization and everyone's kind of trepidation around that at first.
Yeah, there was a period of time when VMware ruled the roost, still does, I guess, in many ways, but the support for relational databases was suspect. And that was suspect sometimes in policy, but very much in hearts and minds. So we had VMware workstations, so it would spin up NT4.0 or 2000 or XP or whatever and have multiple machines. So easy to do as the tech or the developer to test this code or test this change when you can just spin up this virgin image, you know, brand new installation of XP. You don't have to go through all the trouble of building it. Just snap off a copy and boom, there it goes. So there was this promise of why not do that for servers? And my boss at the time, Mark, had some concerns, and I understand it. The company really depends on those services, right? Email, file storage. It's not the kind of place that you want to just say, let's try this science experiment. I got this thing in my garage. Let's get the generator going and let's try it and see what happens. He was appropriately a little averse to that type of experimentation and risk, but eventually over time, we kept talking about it and we did try it out. And lo and behold, it did exactly what it was supposed to do. And we eventually did run Exchange on it. We ran SQL for the enterprise on VMware virtualized, among many other, of course, guest OSs on just a handful of hosts. And that was really a game changer for us because it allowed us to shrink the footprint to the data center and across all the attendant environmental conditioning we all take for granted now, but at the time was really novel and new and was really at the cutting edge. It's all the time you see that in IT where there's a sea change between something like a physical to virtual move. So that was really amazing to see.
Yeah, I remember the databases and the Exchange server were the two last ones where they're like, these things have transaction logs. And if that thing lies and it's not actually written all the way to disk,
that's right.
If the hypervisor is BSing the host OS, then we're in trouble.
Yeah, and that's what a lot of the white papers were about, because a hosted operating system, when it wants to write to disk, when you're not physically writing to the disk, you're writing to a virtualized machine that has that abstraction layer, the commit can be resolved at the OS level, but there is no data committed to disk.
Flush the buffer, call fsync, come on.
That's right.
So from there, you moved on to Stanodyne. What are you up to there?
Yeah, Stanodyne, mid-sized organization based here in the United States, fuel systems company. You can see from the company's website, General Motors, one of our biggest customers. We have locations here in the US. We have locations in the EU and out in India and China as well. And this is a return to one of my biggest passions, which is, as mentioned earlier, SharePoint, standing up brand new intranet based on SharePoint and really leveraging what we hadn't had a chance to talk about yet, and that is metadata. Now, maybe a lot of listeners to the podcast understand metadata, and we use metadata all the time. What time did we get this text message? When was the last time this file was updated? Who was the last person to change this file? Those are all pieces of metadata. If there's a Word document, inside the Word document is not the timestamp in the file system. It doesn't have any of that information, but you can still see the timestamp that's associated with that Word doc when you committed it to disk. So in SharePoint, you can create what's called managed metadata. And this is just Amazon or Alibaba. It's shopping, right? You go to Target or you go to Amazon and you type in bookends. And then you're like, okay, well, I really want wood bookends. So you check that box, right? And says wood. So now you're only looking at wood bookends. But I'm not spending $200 on some wood bookends. So you move that little slider and the slider goes from $15 to $50. And before you know it, on Amazon, what was probably tens of thousands of results for bookends is now, I don't know, maybe 100, 200. You know, you can continue to narrow it down. And that is the magic of enterprise content management based on SharePoint. So when you have managed metadata in SharePoint, you can create a whole category, for example, called location. And a location can be this office and the one in Florida, Tallahassee, Columbia. And then you can create another one for, I don't know, Milan or Brescia or other locations. And then when you go to put the document into SharePoint, you apply that label. Let's say you want to take some time off, right? So you search for the word vacation, same way you search for bookends. So now you're looking at the company's information and all of these documents pop up in search results that happen to have the word vacation in them. But I don't care about any of that. I just want to know what the company's policy around vacation time is. How much have I accrued? Well, you check the box, right? The filter or the refiner, maybe for HR. So you filter it by the department that created the document that has a word vacation in it. Or maybe you check the one that says policy. Same thing inside your company. You can have the same type of power that you can use to refine your search results for bookends on Amazon. You can have that to make those documents available to your colleagues in SharePoint. We talked a lot about allowing employees to have the freedom to enrich that information, right? To be able to commit more improvements over time to this data. Well, that's all fine, well, and good, but if you can't find it, it's not helping anybody. If you can't get that information back out of your systems. And that's one of the things that managed metadata, and that, as I mentioned before, the magic of enterprise content management can achieve for an organization via SharePoint.
Yeah, the keyword search will get you so far, and then maybe some tagging will help, but really adding those facets that you're talking about where I can say I only want policy documents.
That's right.
That contain vacation. You know, we built a solution for a customer where they needed to be able to show the licensure for a certain agent. Mm. So, all right, given this agent and these years, show me his licensure from then. And it was much easier to drill down that way than trying to keyword search your way out of it.
That's right. And it's interesting because a lot of people intuit that, you know, when they think about finding information, particularly on things like shopping sites, they can navigate that really well. But it's a novel thing inside of a lot of organizations to use that search and refine approach. So yeah, that's what we're doing here at Stanodyne. We have a lot of the business units, a lot of the business functions for Stanodyne on board. And one of the passions, right, for a lot of folks in IT, particularly that have responsibility for IT and companies, is user adoption. A little bit of the horse to water thing. If people don't see the value intrinsically to themselves, it's hard to drive that change. But when you make the promise that says, I can pretty much guarantee you that you're going to find what you're looking for when you go into this intranet, into the Stanodyne One product that we're creating for you, and then you do it, then you can get employee adoption.
when they see the benefit, when they feel it, when they're like, oh, that was so much easier.
Yeah. So if somebody got hurt, and this is back at Lenza, somebody got hurt, the CEO wanted to see the safety, you know, the accident report, what happened, really took it very seriously, Chuck, and reviewed every single one of them, talked with the safety committee, and Tina slipped and fell on some ice in the parking lot, and Dale had responsibility for this. He was the safety manager. And while he was out traveling, his team had released a new copy of a form. It had gone from the accident report form to the incident report form. A subtle change, but an important one, right? We want to know if somebody almost got hurt, too. We could maybe take some actions and prevent somebody from getting hurt. So he submitted the accident report form to the CEO. And Chuck answered Dale and said, well, can you please use the new incident report form? And did I mention, by the way, that Dale was responsible for the group that created the incident? So he spent the better part of a morning trying to find this doggone incident report form that got created while he was out of the office. And he eventually did, but he said off and on, it took him about 4 hours. You know, not the entire time, he's doing other things too, but it took him a whole morning to find his own team's incident report form. So I asked him, Dale, how'd you feel about that? And he said, I felt stupid. And I get it. I get it. And that is a really powerful calling to somebody in IT. Let's help people be able to find what it is that they're looking for. There's nothing more rewarding, right, than implementing a system and then seeing the users adopt it and really taking advantage of it and seeing the benefit of it, and really exciting times at Standardine.
Seeing that cumulative time saved, the cumulative effort saved, that they can now do something else.
And you have these little evangelists now walking around for you, Andrew. Dale was one of my biggest proponents, right? He would sell the product for me in the organization, because when I showed him how, you know, you can just put in incident and then you get a bajillion silly documents and that, but you check this filter, this refiner, and now you're only seeing forms that have the title incident in them, and then boom, he finds his document instantly. That's a big, big change for a company.
Definitely. So in your free time, do you have any hobbies you want to tell the listeners about?
I recently discovered that I like camping, got an RV, and I actually am told that it's glamping. It's not camping.
It's too nice.
Yeah. I don't like camping, actually, now that I think about it. I'd rather hate it. Anything that has a paper-thin tent involved in sleeping on branches and things, that's not the kind of thing I'm enjoying. But this RV, yeah, it's a lot of fun. I do like it.
That's cool. Have you gone anywhere neat with it yet?
Well, with COVID, we weren't well received in other states, along with everybody else, apparently. A state here in Massachusetts went out to October Mountain. Really spectacular. Fabulous state park.
That's cool. I've only rented a few for the barbecue competitions, but it was fun to like plunk down somewhere and have your little hotel on wheels and
yeah,
do what you want.
Yeah, exactly right. It's like driving around your tiny little crappy house, but you've got your crappy little house with you no matter where you go. Yeah, it's a pretty neat little idea. And in practice, for us at least, we love it.
Well, hopefully with things opening up, you can spread your wings and explore a little more.
Yeah, up and down the Eastern Seaboard, we're thinking next. Yeah, that'll be just fine by us.
Doug, thank you very much for coming down and joining us and sharing all your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
It was great being here, Andrew. Thanks.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.